This free State of Belief radio podcast is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, representing 185,000 members across the U.S., drawn from 75 different faith traditions. We're committed to protecting faith and freedom. Find out about the work we do to protect the boundaries between religion and government and unite diverse voices to challenge extremism and build common ground by visiting our website, interfaithalliance.org. Whether you care deeply about minority religious rights, school bullying, LGBT discrimination, the influence of religion on politics, or the influence of politics on religion, Interfaith Alliance is working on initiatives you'll want to support. Learn more and become a member at interfaithalliance.org. From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C.
It doesn't take away from my Christianity. It doesn't diminish it at all to be in conversation with people of other religious traditions. It makes me learn to articulate what I believe.
For many years, one of the leading voices for inclusivity and affirmation, both within and beyond the Episcopal Church, has been that of Right Reverend Jane Holmes Dixon. As the second woman to be consecrated a bishop in that church, she never has backed down from her vision of a denomination that welcomes both the gifts and the needs of all people. As an interfaith activist, she has worked to build bridges among disparate communities in our nation and has been a powerful voice for inclusivity and cooperation. On November 13th, Bishop Jane will receive the Interfaith Alliance Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award in New York City. Today on State of Belief Radio, you'll find out why when she joins me here in the studio to talk about her life and her work. But first...
Well, it was 10 years ago that President Bush signed the USA Patriot Act into law, designed to give the FBI more counterterrorism power in an era of extraordinary fear. Noble intentions, perhaps, but power, as we know, when it is allocated to a few without any visibility and without any enforcement mechanism for integrity, can be a complicated thing at best, an exquisitely dangerous one at worst.
We've all been affected by some of those changes, even if only in small ways. But one population that truly saw everything change is Muslim Americans. And a new report out from the organization Muslim Advocates contends that much of U.S. policy has remained mired in immediate post-9/11 fears and assumptions for the intervening decade. Muslim Advocates has just issued a new call for change, a comprehensive report titled Losing Liberty, the State of American Freedom 10 Years After the Patriot Act. Farhana Kara, President and Executive Director of Muslim Advocates, she's been on State of Belief Radio before. It's always a pleasure to work with her. Farhana, welcome back.
Thank you for having me again, Welton. Thank you.
Prior to your work with Muslim Advocates and the National Association of Muslim Lawyers, you were counsel to the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee, Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Property Rights. You worked extensively with Senator Russ Feingold on civil rights issues directly related to the Patriot Act. So you are really uniquely positioned to be deeply familiar with both the intent and the effects of this legislation. Farhana, what went wrong?
You know, I was in the halls of Congress on September 11th, 2001, and in the subsequent days and weeks after those horrific attacks on our nation. And my colleagues and I were not only, you know, in that realm of Americans who were targeted on that day, September 11th, but a few weeks later, we would also be affected by the anthrax mailings. So I am very personally familiar with what it feels like to be worried about safety and security. I also recognize that, you know, we have something pretty special in our country.
Mm-hmm.
The freedoms that we have, that our founding fathers had the infinite wisdom to write into our founding charter are unique. And those are values that we need to be working hard every day as Americans to be ensuring that our country is actually living up to those ideals. And that's why my organization, Muslim Advocates, is so concerned about one of the first major pieces of legislation that was enacted by Congress back in 2001, purporting to address terrorism, the USA Patriot Act. But our concern is that law and subsequent laws and policies enacted by federal law enforcement agencies, including the FBI, have actually done the opposite, that they've actually eroded America's freedoms and they waste precious resources.
Were you surprised at how ugly that proposed helpful legislation got?
I was. I still remember fairly vividly some of the conversations that were happening before the bill ever actually even made it to the Senate floor, where some of the early proposals were basically hearkening back to the Alien Sedition Act, to Japanese internment.
Mm-hmm.
There was really a need for people to be able to say, you know, hold on a minute here. Yes, our country is facing some unique unprecedented security situations, but at the same time, history has shown that our country loses when we give in to fear and when we change our fundamental character and our fundamental values.
Summarize, if you will, some of the findings of Muslim Advocates' report that really verify we still have work to do related to the Patriot Act.
Yeah. So basically, our report, Losing Liberty, illustrates the ways in which the Patriot Act really opened the floodgates to a number of different activities in which Americans, innocent Americans, are targeted for surveillance, for investigations, without any evidence of wrongdoing. It's not uncommon for American Muslims in particular, to get a knock on the door or to have the FBI show up at their workplace suddenly asking them about something they've posted on their Facebook account, like an article about political events.
Mm-hmm.
We also hear from a lot of American Muslims who are being asked at the border when they're returning home from overseas travel, and this is U.S. citizens, who are being asked questions like, what mosque do you attend? How often do you pray? Questions that are frankly just Orwellian in nature. Mm. So what we want and what we describe in this report is we need law enforcement focused on actual threats, actual mm-hmm. criminals, not innocent Americans. And if Congress does its job in holding the FBI accountable and amending the Patriot Act and other bad laws, I think it will serve all of us better in terms of ensuring our safety while upholding our founding values as Americans.
Just this past couple of weeks, several stories in the New York Times lifted the curtain a little bit on what life is like for Muslim Americans. The report of wholesale NYPD infiltration of virtually every Muslim organization and event in mm-hmm. the city. There's also a story about special scrutiny being given to Muslims who apply to change their names. Will these kind of stories stir more people in this country to stand up and say, this just isn't right?
You know, it's certainly my hope that it will prompt more and more Americans to step up and say this is not right, and to press government officials, their local officials, members of Congress, to do their job and to hold law enforcement agencies accountable for essentially bad policing practices. Ultimately, the responsibility lies with Congress and the president. The Patriot Act was enacted by Congress, signed into law by then-President Bush, and the subsequent expansive surveillance activities have been primarily coming out of the FBI, a Department of Homeland Security, and then we have local law enforcement agencies that we believe are basically modeling themselves after the federal agencies. I think there's an enormous responsibility for Congress to act. A lot of what we know unfortunately, is very limited about how the FBI has used the Patriot Act because it's been shrouded in secrecy. And I think Congress and the American people have a right to know how these unprecedented surveillance powers have been used and how those activities are being modeled at the local level.
Farhana Khera is president and executive director of Muslim Advocates, an organization working to foster the civic participation and civil liberties of every American. They've just issued a stunning report called Losing Liberty, The State of American Freedom 10 Years After the Patriot Act. You can download this report from their website, MuslimAdvocates.org. Farhana, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us again today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Wilton.
We've got to take a short break, but coming right up, we'll be joined in the studio by Bishop Jane Holmes Dixon, one of the recipients of this year's Interfaith Alliance Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards, and someone who has devoted her life to opening doors within and beyond the Episcopal Church. It's a conversation I'm eager to have. It's a conversation you will not want to miss. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio, everyone. I'm Welton Gaddy. When the Right Reverend Jane Holmes Dixon was ordained to the Episcopal priesthood in 1982, I cannot imagine that she foresaw the challenges that lay ahead. She assumed ever-increasing responsibilities, including leadership of the Episcopal Diocese of Washington, D.C. The church was faced with conflict and divisiveness on issues, including the role of women and lesbian gay persons. As the second woman consecrated as a bishop in the Episcopal Church, she never shied away from addressing these issues, and in addition, she found time to participate in important interfaith work. Fortunately for us, included serving as chair of the Board of Interfaith Alliance, as well as a staff position with the Interfaith Alliance. Bishop Jane retired from the Episcopal Church in 2002, but she continues to be a trailblazer in the areas that need her inclusive spirit the most. With warm congratulations on receiving this year's Interfaith Alliance Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award, I'm so very pleased to welcome the Right Reverend Jane Holmes Dixon back to State of Belief Radio. Jane, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here, Welton.
Winona, Mississippi, where you grew up as a child, to Washington, D.C., where you served as a bishop in the Episcopal Church, to Oxford University and other such venues of heady importance. How did you get here from where you came from?
I was blessed, Welton, to grow up in a family where religion was central. I grew up in the Presbyterian Church, U.S., as we used to say, and church attendance on Sunday morning, Sunday afternoon, Sunday evening, Wednesday night prayer meeting were part of our lifestyle. When I went away to college in 1955 to school in Virginia, Randolph Macon Women's College, the civil rights movement was stirring and beginning. Dr. King was beginning to lead in Birmingham and was reading about that in the paper. It had never really impacted my life. However, I transferred to Vanderbilt University in 1958. I met a man who was a senior in law school when I was a senior in undergraduate school, David Dixon, to whom I've been married now for 51 years. And I often say that he took my hand and led me into the movement for human rights. We were fortunate to move into an Episcopal church there in Nashville, where the rector had wonderful meetings on Sunday afternoons in the basement of the church, where African-American clergy would come, we would meet, we would talk about what we were seeing. And so that journey began where I could see the civil rights movement, human rights, and how that related to the gospel. My husband and I got very enthralled with President Kennedy. and decided that we would come to Washington to be a part of the new frontier. The president was assassinated before we got here, but we came ahead, arrived here in the spring of 1964. Once again, we got involved with the Episcopal Church, and the rector there at the time was very involved in human rights movement, and so that continued. And how I got there is the church was the place where I acted out, literally, my move into the women's movement. Again, the inclusion of all people, and began to meet people who were openly gay and lesbian, and connecting the gospel to what I believe is God's call for the dignity and worth of every human being. It progressed from there. The Episcopal Church began to ordain women in 1974, irregularly, but by the time I went to seminary in 1977, the Episcopal Church had voted to ordain women. I went to seminary in 77, and as you said, I was ordained in 82.
As a young woman coming out of Winona, Mississippi, did you ever entertain the idea that you might in your life be a part of major change in the American religious community and in the civil rights situation in this nation?
In terms of the civil rights movement, no. That did not happen until we left Nashville. My husband and I knew that we needed to get away from the South to be able to live into some of the things that we believed in.
Right. When did you decide to study for the ministry?
I was confronted by a woman who's a great mentor in my life, Dr. Verna Dozier, African-American woman here in Washington who was head of the English department for the D.C. Public Schools. And I was telling her at lunch one day that I was sure that our son David, who was at the time 12 or 13, was going to be a priest. And she looked at me and she said, "Listen here, if you want to be a priest, you do it, but you leave that boy alone." I rode the train home shortly after that, and my husband picked me up at Union Station, and I told him what Dr. Dozier had said to me, and I thought he was going to laugh and say, "Well, that's the craziest thing I've ever heard." And what he said was, "I think she may be right." That was the second step of validation. And then in the Episcopal Church, we are asked in the ordination vows, "Do you believe that God and the church are calling you to ordination?" I hope and pray that God is calling me.
Did you have to go back to school at that point?
Mm-hmm. I had graduated from Vanderbilt with a BA in 59. We were married in there in Nashville, and I got an MAT in 62. But the Episcopal Church generally requires that you do a three-year seminary. So in 1977, I went to Virginia Theological Seminary, and in the spring of 1989, the Bishop of Washington made me a postulant, which is the first step toward ordination, and so then I received a Master of Divinity in 1981.
How did it happen for you to become a bishop? I mean, did you want that?
Well, I had often said I was too old. I was not ordained until I was 43 years old. And it never occurred to me that given my life that I would have in the church that I would be a bishop.
I'd like for you to pick a couple of issues, if you will, or turning points in your work, moments for which you're grateful today because you had a place at the table.
When now the Reverend Elizabeth Carl came to the diocese, she came through the process. There was concern about the fact that she was open about her sexuality. She was in a long-time partnership. And whether or not we would approve her in the Episcopal system, I was there at the table, and she is one of the most committed, faithful Christian persons I've ever known. And so I had the privilege on that night at Church of the Epiphany to say that we do believe that all persons are created in the image of God. The other was when I was the ecclesiastical authority in 2000, I was presented with a situation with a congregation in the diocese who wanted to call a rector. And this is a man who had written extensively about the work of a rector was to take churches out of the Episcopal system, that we were, in his language, this is a quote, going to hell in a handbasket. And he wouldn't leave the congregation. And I had no recourse but to go to the civil court. That was important to me because we have to have structures in which to live. And unless we change those structures, we live within them.
I'm talking to the Right Reverend Jane Holmes Dixon, a recipient of this year's Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award. We've got to take a short break. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. This free State of Belief radio podcast is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, representing 185,000 members across the U.S., drawn from 75 different faith traditions. We're committed to protecting faith and freedom. Find out about the work we do to protect the boundaries between religion and government and unite diverse voices to challenge extremism and build common ground by visiting our website, interfaithalliance.org. Whether you care deeply about minority religious rights, school bullying, LGBT discrimination, the influence of religion on politics, or the influence of politics on religion, Interfaith Alliance is working on initiatives you'll want to support. Learn more and become a member at interfaithalliance.org. Welcome back, everyone, to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. I'm talking to the Right Reverend Jane Holmes Dixon, a recipient of this year's Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award given by Interfaith Alliance, and a lifelong trailblazer for the cause of inclusion and celebration of diversity, both within and beyond the Episcopal Church. How did you get to be involved in interfaith activism?
When I was at St. Albans Church in the late 79, when I went to be a seminarian there, St. Albans Church, right up here on Mount St. Alban, was involved with Washington Hebrew Congregation, as well as the Roman Catholic Church down the street. And one of the things that the rector had me do as part of my training was to be involved in that. And so I got to know folk, particularly at Washington Hebrew. I came back to St. Albans in the mid-80s to be the associate rector, and that was part of my job description. And so I began to work particularly with Washington Hebrew, and when I became rector out in Laurel, there was a group from the Washington Hebrew congregation who came to celebrate my institution as rector. A wonderful friendship. Then in Laurel, the Desert Storm came about. And it seemed important to me that we in that Episcopal Church, which was down on the main street of Laurel, to have a prayer service and to invite all the faith traditions that were in that community. And they were gracious enough to come. When I was elected bishop, our ecumenical and interfaith work became part again of my job description. Bishop Haynes gave me that privilege. And so I began to work with religious leaders here in Washington. And as you know, as the Interfaith Alliance was getting started, people came to talk to me about that. And so it went from there. And to me, the goodness of that, and as I think you know, our daughter converted to Judaism. And so interfaith relationship became personal as well as the work that I had done.
I'm curious as to when you look at the big picture, how different does the Christian religion look today than it looked when you got started in ministry?
Well, I have to look at that on many different ways, but in terms of the interfaith, I mean, that was, I do not remember a course in Virginia Seminary being offered. I'm sure that people studied religious, different religions in undergraduate schools. We thought it was pretty out there to take a course at Catholic University. That was the only place that liberation theology was being taught back in the late 70s. But in terms of real interaction with Jewish brothers and sisters, Muslim brothers and sisters, now, within the Diocese of Washington, that was not true. Bishop Walker and some others had formed the interfaith group here. The Reverend Clark Lobenstein heads that. So that was becoming part of life in the Diocese of Washington. So that was supported by that. But now it's clergy are encouraged to learn about that in seminary. We always stressed when I was at the diocese that clergy work with ministers of other religions, where it was maybe it happened if you happened to be with a priest who was doing that. Speak best about the Episcopal Diocese of Arden. It's encouraged, but it's true in many dioceses across this country. And so you see it on a regular basis. And of course, our relationships with people throughout the world, given the travel, the ease of travel these days, the internet, all of that. And we've learned that this is important for our life.
Different churches face different challenges, so I know that there's no one-size-fits-all answer to this next question, but if you could give one piece of hard-earned advice to activists within the Episcopal and other churches and faith communities who are working right now to open more doors, to tear down more barriers, faithfully include more people in the life of those communities, what would that advice be?
I believe, Welton, that there are more folk who are willing to be engaged in these conversations than we think. I think to sit there and think, well, they're not really willing to interact with me because we have different views on theology. I just don't think that's true. I think that people want to be engaged with one another. And I think if I would give any advice to anybody, it's to reach out a hand. People can only tell you no. But the important thing is so many more people are willing, I believe, to tell you yes. Now, I'm a blessed person. My introduction back in the late 70s was to a Jewish congregation who were open to having that conversation with me and helping me form as an Episcopal priest. Now, that's not everybody's good fortune, and I know that. But it was certainly my work in Laurel, Maryland, to work with the congregation there. In fact, I had the rabbi read the scripture, the Hebrew scripture, at my consecration in 1992. So I think that there's more goodwill out there, and I just think it takes that risk, and I will sort of tout the horn of the Episcopal Church. I think we've been better about that than some other religious traditions.
Yeah. Well, I know that one sign of wisdom in the Episcopal Church is that they regularly ask you to speak with young ministers, especially young women ministers studying for the priesthood. Would you talk with first-year seminarians or people who are on their way to ordination, what do you tell them you think the biggest challenges of the future will be for them?
That's a really interesting question and one that's very hard to answer. Why are we not being able to tell the story, as politicians would say, our narrative? Why are we not being able to tell that with the power and the life-changing ability that it certainly has had on my life? And how are they going to be in today's world and to do that, to do it faithfully? Because one of the things I learned at the Interfaith Alliance, as well as with the other interfaith work I have done, it doesn't take away from my Christianity. It doesn't diminish it at all. To be in conversation with people of other religious traditions. It makes me learn to articulate what I believe. And so that's what I would say and what I have said. How are you going to get that message out? And I think so much of it is not only telling it, but living it.
Jane, what do you think about today?
What do I think about
today? What are you thinking these days? Is it looking back on your ministry? Is it looking at what's going on around us? Is it so? I mean, I know you read broadly, and I'm just wondering what you're thinking about.
Well, I'm very excited, Welton, because the Diocese of Washington has just elected a new bishop. She will be consecrated on the 12th of November. Female, the Reverend Dr. Mary Ann Edgar Buddy. And what I think about is how is this young woman going to lead this church into the future? She's a faithful Christian person. She's brilliant. And so I think a lot about the hope that I have that these questions that I have, that this is a person who knows how to blog, who knows how to use new forms of communication. So I think about that. I think about our country a lot, our place in the world. I worry about the fact that we seem to be becoming mean-spirited, that we are really not much interested in loving our brothers and sisters as ourselves. And what can I, as a retired 74-year-old woman, do about that? I think about that every day. I do sometimes go back and yearn for the days when it seemed to me to be more simple, that the issues of civil rights and women's rights and the acceptance of gay and lesbian people seemed to be more clear-cut, and so the struggle was easier. I think about all this occupying Wall Street or Freedom Plaza, and the folk that are out there, how are they going to get focused and really make a difference? Because the inequity, the economic inequity in this world is tragic. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the things I think about.
What's the one question you wish I'd asked you today, but I didn't ask you?
What has given me the support and the strength to do what the goodness that I've been led into.
So why don't you answer that?
Well, as I said to you, I am blessed with a man, my husband, for these many years, who is a faithful Christian, a wonderful human being who loves me enough to tell me the truth. I've had incredible mentors. And I've had a rich prayer life. My prayer life is probably not like a lot of other people's, but it has sustained me through days and helps me every day. But it's that interaction with one of the things that I have known is the Episcopal Church, one of our central tenets, of course, is the Incarnation. Mm-hmm. And I have found that if I'm faithful, that God will bring someone into my life when I need that person to either open a door, to help me see another perspective. And so those are the things that have given me the strength and the courage. When you ask me, what did people say? How did this happen for you? How did you get here? Is that's been true for me.
Been speaking with the Right Reverend Jane Holmes Dixon, the second woman consecrated as a bishop in the Episcopal Church, a resolute leader, a courageous dissident when the need arose, and a trailblazer for the cause of inclusion both within and beyond her church. In the tradition from which I come, we observe in the fall Reformation Sunday, a time for looking at what's going on in the church, and that's closely associated with a holiday that is important in the Anglican Church, which is All Souls Day, of remembering people who have gone before us. One Sunday on Reformation Sunday and All Souls Day in our congregation, I started naming people who in my tradition are the heroes, heroines of the Reformation and continuing the Reformation. And I think I told you, but I want to tell our listeners, Jane Holmes Dixon is on that list, and she is very worthy of being there, and she is one of the people that gives strength and hope to people who look at religion and sometimes say, what in the heck is going on? And they see her, and they know that something really good is going on. Bishop Jane, congratulations again on receiving the Faith and Freedom Award named after Walter Cronkite. And thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. I'm honored, and thank you for those incredible words. It means a lot to me.
The Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards will be given by Interfaith Alliance at a gala dinner in New York City on Sunday evening, November 13th. If you'd like to attend, we'd love to have you. Please visit interfaithalliance.org for complete information. We've got to take a break, but please stay tuned. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio, everyone. I'm Welton Gaddy. As calm and reasoned as I make sure this show always is, we are a part of a battle that is dramatically escalating, and I'm going to need you to be a part of that battle with us, even if only in a small way. Because of early voting in some states, we're now technically less than 1 year away from the start of the actual 2012 elections that will play a critical role in determining our nation's future. I have never, nor will I ever, tell you how to vote. But I have always, and I will continue, to draw your attention to the ways that religion, fear-mongering, and violation of constitutional principles, both real and promised, pollute our political landscape. And yes, it's possible to operate a democracy without those influences. I'm a preacher who is in the pulpit every Sunday, but I have worked for many years to protect religion from abuse, from being cheapened by keeping it out of the political process. It is possible. Last week on this show, we spoke to a very smart young man, an atheist, who's working to build bridges of understanding among religious and irreligious people because he knows that faith misunderstood is faith vulnerable to manipulation and misuse. When protesters first took to the streets and the still-growing Occupy movement, the reactions were varied and often dismissive. Many compared the other 99% to the Tea Party movement. But in recent weeks, Occupy encampments in New York, Chicago, Atlanta, Albuquerque, and other cities have met with violence from police authorities. Maybe it didn't want to be, but the movement is now a battle. And there's a battle being waged on the airwaves and on the internet as well. Shrewd organizers are using their extensive reach via radio, television, and the web to promote a faith-based political agenda like never before. And leading political candidates are speaking this language like never before. We've posted a video on our website, stateofbelief.com. I hope you will take a look at it. In fact, you really need to take a look at it. And I hope you'll let it sink in. This is not a call for 5 million conservative Christians to go to church more, or even to bring others to church with them. This is a call for 5 million conservative Christians to step into the political arena and swing the vote in multiple states. Now listen, maybe you think that's okay. If so, I would suggest that you take a moment to replace the words conservative Christians in that phrase and make sure that you'd be okay with a concerted campaign to register 5 million Muslims or 5 million Orthodox Jews or 5 million fill-in-the-blanks, and make sure you're okay with any of those scenarios as well. If you have a problem with those scenarios, but subscribe to the David Barton School of America was founded as a Christian nation, all I can tell you is that revisionist history is verifiably, objectively, permanently false. It's a lie. Now, to digress for just a moment, did you know that in certain Eastern European and other countries, every time an election cycle is completed, they replace all the history books? Do you know that? I don't think we want to move toward that here in the United States. And a part of the battle that I'm talking about involves ensuring that doesn't happen. Every week at the end of this show, I invite you to talk about what you've heard with your family and friends and encourage them to listen too. I ask you to put together conversations that will continue the discussions that begin on State of Belief Radio. Starting this week, I'd like to challenge you to do just a little bit more. If you're on Facebook, visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/stateofbelief. We post the stories you hear on this show right there. It's the easiest way to share them with others, and I urge you to do that. even if your comment is, I can't believe the ridiculous stuff they're talking about on State of Belief Radio, share that also. Have at it. Connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter. Help spread the word in these new ways that were never available before. And if you have a blog, we provide transcripts of our interviews at stateofbelief.com for easy quoting. If there's a radio station in your area that should be broadcasting State of Belief Radio, let them know about us. Tell them to give us a call or tell us and we'll call them. Look, I don't particularly like talking in terms of battle, but that's where we are, friends. And the silent majority remains silent at its peril. What I'm asking is, if you find this program important, don't keep it to yourself. I love hearing from listeners every week. But now it's even more important that potential listeners hear from you who listen. Spread the word. And please start doing it right now, this week. Tell us the stories if you can. Visit us online at stateofbelief.com to find out more about the show and sign up for our podcast. Contact information is available at stateofbelief.com, including the listener line 202-238-3291. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. I hope you'll become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. Let's work together, friends, and then join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. But until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, Welton.